Hey, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is January 8th, 2020. Happy New Year. We are live at CES. And to my left, Andrew Martinick.
Hello. You didn't do the incorrect 2019 thing. Well done.
I know. I'm learning and growing as a human. Also growing and learning as a human, Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, is across from me.
Every day, my friend. Thank you for having me.
Every day.
In my own damn hotel room.
Sorry. Not sorry, I suppose. Hayato Huseman, welcome back.
I have learned nothing.
Good. Good man. And Russell Hawley, the man who knows everything.
I have learned plenty, but refuse to apply it in any practical sense.
That's what humans do, actually. I think we're on a roll. All right. So we are, we're rolling into 2020. We're rolling. It's day two.
Yeah.
Crazy
of the show.
To think it's only day two, but we've seen a lot and done a lot and walked a lot. So let's get going. We're kind of going to go through products, but we can just talk about stuff that we've seen, stuff, dogs that we've seen and loved.
I'm up to 13 dogs.
Wait for that on AC. So, let's start with, day negative two. We'll talk about the Galaxy S10 Lite, Note 10 Lite, and the Galaxy Chromebook. Andrew.
Yeah.
They're red. What else do we need to know about those?
The Galaxy Chromebook is red.
Well, there is a red version of one of them.
The Note 10 Lite. Is that right? Yeah. Well, I didn't really care about those plasticky things.
Ooh,
I was mostly using the
shade.
Really expensive Galaxy Chromebook.
I see where this podcast is going.
Right. Which is very red, except for the one that's silver, which most people will buy. But the red one is going to look really good in advertisements. $1,000 starting price on a Chromebook, which is, you know, that's a lot for a lot of people. But man, 4K OLED screen, real nice.
Say the thing that that was the headline for the post, because that's the thing I'm most interested in.
Okay, so the reason why it's a $1,000 Chromebook is that Google worked really closely with Samsung on this particular model, because in their eyes, it's effectively the replacement for the Pixelbook. It is the Pixelbook 2 because they're not going to release one.
So that's from Google.
Google said that, yes.
Okay.
The head of product development for Chrome OS or something like that. Somebody very high up at Google said they're not making a Pixelbook 2, so they're happy to work with a partner and get the name like Samsung Galaxy behind it. So it actually gives it a shot of, you know, having a couple sales. Although they said the Pixelbook outperformed their expectations, doesn't mean they didn't have expectations that were incredibly, incredibly low, because I highly doubt they sold very many of them. But general, marketplace, someone is more likely to spend $1,000 on a Samsung laptop than a Google one. Anyway, it's still a Chromebook, which is, you know, hurting it in that respect. But if you are a Chromebook person, it's got all the things. It has a 10th generation Core i5, 8 or 16 gigs of RAM, up to a terabyte of storage.
Wait, it has a 10th gen?
Yeah.
It's the first 10th gen in a Chromebook.
It is the first 10th gen in a Chromebook. It's also the first 4K OLED screen in a Chromebook. Mm. The thing weighs about a little over two pounds.
It's crazy thin.
Super thin, dual USB-C, micro SD card, backlit keyboard, huge trackpad, like really nice industrial design. Keyboard is a little bit like mashed potatoes.
Yeah, it's mushy.
It's really quiet, but it's very soft. So that's kind of the only downside that I noticed from it. But otherwise, really, really nice.
So Galaxy S10 and Note 10 Lights, why?
You tell me.
Not just why, but 2 days after S11 invites went out.
Yeah. It was not compelling in the way that a Galaxy announcement is usually compelling. Michael, I'd love your take on this, because we're at a point now where Samsung releases, you know, 11 million phones a year.
Right.
Roughly.
But these are the first Galaxy-branded or flagship-branded phones that have the Lite moniker from Samsung.
Yeah.
And a lot of people made the joke that there is already an S10 Lite. It's the S10e. But that's not this.
No, not at all. And in terms of positioning, strategy, branding approach, marketing,
you know, all the things.
I mean, I am not qualified to say it's a bad idea. I think they may sell in volume. All I can say is People were asking me, are you going to look at the Note 10 Lite when you go see the Chromebook? And I said, absolutely. It's a Note. I've been interested in every single Note up to this point. And I held that thing for maybe 4 seconds. And I was like, I want nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
It is confusing to me. It was initially confusing to me when Samsung launched the Galaxy name itself in, 2010? When I was like, oh, that means high-end Android competitor to the iPhone, Galaxy. But then they started putting Galaxy on everything, and it just became, oh, okay, it's just a Samsung product. It's like a double brand. But that was fine. Now we have S and Note being appended to just demonstrably inferior products. And I don't know why. It confuses me. I have no interest in holding either of them ever again. And I it'll be interesting to see if this approach persists.
And the thing about them is, I agree, it takes less than 4 seconds to tell that these are not of the same level of quality at all.
Yeah, it felt like a Galaxy S3.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very plasticky and cheap feeling. But the thing is that they feel like the Galaxy A51 and A71 that I just used today, which are proper mid-range phones. They're Galaxy A series devices, which is the whole point. They're $300 to $400 or so, and they are plasticky, and you're just paying for good specs and screen and not the outside part. You expect that in a Galaxy A, not in a Galaxy S or Note.
Correct.
Yeah, very cool that you...
That's what makes them confusing.
Well, it's very cool that you can get an S Pen in a lower-end device. Like, that is a compelling thing, but the rest is just awful.
Well, it's so strange that they put the older Exynos processor from, the Galaxy S8 in the Note 10 Lite.
Yeah.
But the S10 Lite has the 855, like every other, flagship from last year.
And the A51 and A71 are the same.
Yeah.
One has a Snapdragon, one has an Exynos.
But, why is the Note series the lower-powered one this time?
It makes and also, sense. The Note has a headphone jack and the S doesn't.
Yes.
Which is the opposite of what the flagships do.
Maybe this is just further reinforcement. First of all, you're right to talk about the S Pen in a lower range device because that is a gap that's existed in Samsung's lineup forever. Well, LG has been sort
stylo,
of
man.
Mopping up with stylo.
Yeah. Well,
so
in that tier.
Is it just that these phones are being sold in places where the normal S's aren't currently there?
We don't really know. Yeah,
it's definitely in a price point that would make it fully appealing.
I guess I just wonder if that's the angle, because the S branding is incredibly powerful, as you have obviously attested to, and rightfully so. I wonder if the point is to not get the S branding muddied here so much as make sure that the people who would otherwise not be able to get the S branding, like in Brazil, be able to have the feel like they have a part of that S branding.
Yeah, you walk that fine line of leaning on the powerful brands and diluting the powerful brands.
Absolutely. Yeah. Completely agree.
Before we get too far away from the stylus thing, though, and I'm sorry I tuned out a little bit for the Chromebook chat, but
We didn't talk about the Chromebook has a stylus,
S-Pen,
too.
S Pen, a siloed S Pen in a Chromebook.
Yeah.
And
wasn't it in the Chromebook Plus, though?
Yes. Yeah,
it was in the Chromebook Plus.
I guess I just didn't.
But it wasn't very good, and it was that was part of... Google, in the previous generation of the Chromebook releases, had a very specific standard for what they would consider acceptable for the stylus and wouldn't let any of the manufacturers deviate from it. So the stylus that Samsung uses is actually the exact same stylus that Dell was using in its systems, and neither of them were very good. And both companies actually recognized that they weren't very good and weren't super happy about it when they were doing demos with us about it. And so it's actually good that what we're seeing in this Chromebook is actually Samsung's proper S Pen.
Right.
That tells me that Samsung was able to kind of push back a little bit, and Google received that feedback and actually made some changes, which I think is going to make all of the next generation Chromebooks for the better as a result.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, speaking of S Pens, that the Note 10 Lite's S Pen is interchangeable with the regular Note 10's S Pen.
Yeah.
We tried it. I was wincing at the prospect of breaking the phone. I just pushed it and it clicked and it was fine. But yeah, so that's great. What's interesting, too, rumored pricing. The Note 10 Lite is going to be 50 euros cheaper than the S10 Lite. We're looking at 600 euros for the Note 10 Lite and 650 for the S10 Lite.
The only way that makes sense to me is if the speculation we had earlier in the year or earlier last year rings true. The new Note is the Fold family. You want to go crazy and spend a lot of money and get something nutso, you buy a Galaxy Fold, whatever. And the Note is, will be further diversified, further
Well, and that makes sense because one of the biggest complaints about the Note generation, I think also from you, over the last two generations, has been that there's just been not enough distinction between the larger S form and the smaller Note form. They are essentially the same phone.
Absolutely.
So by continuing to kind of grow that Note and put the Fold in that same generation, I feel like that helps deal with that.
Yeah.
So that sort of explains somewhat the deeply confusing bifurcation of the spec sheet. I mean, there is a lot that's same that's the same, but the fact that the cameras on the S10 Lite are completely different than the Note 10 Lite. Let's talk about the S10 Lite's cameras briefly. 48 megapixel super steady OIS. This is probably the first of many times we're going to hear that super steady OIS branding this year. But Samsung has to do something about its camera quality. We know that.
Yeah.
This is sort of a hybrid between what the East, like what Asia and India likes to see in their phones, high megapixels, macro lenses, which we don't really see in the West here, and just a traditional ultra-wide. This phone forgoes the telephoto. And then the Note 10 Lite is basically just a Note 10. 12 by 12 by 12, telephoto, ultra-wide, wide. So
And that combination of 48 and then wide and
macro.
And is there the depth sensing fourth camera on that one?
No.
Okay, because those three are the same as the A51 and A71, but it also has a depth sensing camera on it as well.
So weird.
So it's weird that there are, you know, there are those alignments with the A series and then the Note's completely separate.
So
because the Galaxy A50 did really well at a low price with that 48 megapixel camera. It didn't have the macro camera, but it did really well for about a $300 phone to have, you know, the new 48 megapixel sensor.
And the A line now is sold in the US.
Yeah.
So we can expect the A51 and potentially the A71 to come to the US as well. Who's bored of talking about these phones already?
So bored. Okay,
let's move on. What say you about the OnePlus Concept One? Because still not a super exciting product because it's not really a product, but we should talk about the significance of OnePlus launching, having something at CES, which they've never had before, other than, you know, occasionally wooing us with beer.
So the cool thing about it is just if you just take it at face value, like the leather and glass combination on the back is really neat. And the using of the electrochromic layer in the glass to, you know, hide the cameras and use it as an ND filter is really cool. None of that necessitates this being a concept phone.
Yeah.
They are two things that are 100% doable and shippable in a phone.
Yeah. I mean, I spent all of yesterday walking around the convention center looking at, like, concept cars that were so outlandishly, like, not similar to a car that you would ever see on the road.
And all of these crazy foldables we've seen, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and, like, compared to, like, looking at those concept cars compared to a regular car and then looking at the OnePlus Concept One versus, like, the 7T Pro. It's like, these are basically the same phone.
Right. You would walk around with the Concept One and nobody would bat an eye. It's just a normal phone.
They just think you have a cool case on your 7T Pro.
So let's ask the question that OnePlus hopes nobody's asking. Why would they do this? What is to be gained from coming out at CES and showing, you know, a few members of the media this phone that will never go wider than that?
It seems to me to be it's a branding exercise, but also if you're already playing with that EC stuff because you're going to do some interesting stuff with it, whether it's introducing an ND filter as we saw in this phone or doing something crazy on the display side, if you're already playing with that material and it's relatively easy to make a batch of phones that can be convincingly demoed.
And they had a batch of phones. They had a plenty for everybody to use.
I think that especially when it comes to OnePlus is acutely aware of that its audience is always paying attention to every single thing that it does. And that's kind of a unique thing in this industry. You know, while there are certainly a ton of Samsung fans, there are way more people who have a Samsung phone who they're not really paying attention to what Samsung is doing.
Right.
Just about every OnePlus user is one of those, you know, constantly attached, constantly connected, paying attention to everything that OnePlus is doing. We've seen it, you know, kind of inside baseball thing here, but we see this with web traffic on Android Central. We write something about OnePlus, and even though the phone comparatively does not do super well compared to some of these other phones, that the people who come and read it come from everywhere when it's something that's new. And I think that OnePlus is very, very aware of that, and doing this here means that there's just way more companies that would be now willing to write about it. And it just gives more to their audience. I really think that this was, more than anything else, a love letter to their fans saying, look,
we're all, like, you really like the software stuff that we're doing. We're also trying to do weird stuff with hardware too.
Right.
So that they now have an extremely open platform, especially in places like Reddit, where these fans can now go, I really need that. And that gives them the ammunition that they can then take back to some of these branding partners and say, how much further can we push this thing that we're doing together?
And they're acutely aware that there are very few exciting phone announcements CES, as has been the case for years.
Yeah.
So
this is without a doubt the most exciting. It doesn't matter that it's not coming out.
Yeah.
This is, you know, there are people who are not necessarily phone nerds who are going to see this and get really excited about it.
And I think, like, a few people asked them about, like, why didn't you put this in the front camera? And they, you know, they kind of gave the excuse of, like, well, we tried everything we could. We just couldn't really make it work. But at the same time, it's like, this clearly has, the whole disappearing camera thing has a much more meaningful use for the front camera, where you could actually hide it entirely.
Right.
And, like, you know, even if it doesn't work right this second, maybe a year or two from now we'll see it at, you know, CES or MWC or something else, where you can just have this completely opaque camera at demand on the front of your phone.
Yeah, the technology is really cool.
Yeah.
And just like I really like the design of the leather and all that, I would love to see that in a future phone too. It's just, I would be much more exciting if this was rolled out as a feature of another phone that had a bunch of other features. If you take it just on its own, you're like,
so it's
that's
a Motorola One phone.
Well, you're like, that is a feature.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
would be really cool if it's part of a whole suite of other things that make this phone interesting. Because, like Hayato was saying, you flip this over and it's just a OnePlus 7T Pro.
Yeah.
It is the exact same. And a couple people had asked questions. They were like, "So is there anything else in here?" And they're like, "No, it's just the things on the back."
Yeah.
There was also some interesting speculation from Phil Nickenson about whether this tech would make it outside of the phone and possibly show up in the OnePlus television. Where, you know, where it is also valuable to have, you know, the kind of disappearing sensors or buttons, you know, that would be able to just kind of hide so that you have that television that just looks like a flat glass slab until those things are revealed.
I mean, that's what the Samsung Frame does,
right? That's correct.
Yeah.
And if OnePlus were able to deliver something that kind of felt like that, but at a way lower price point, like that's
Frame
not nothing.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I love the Frame.
Let's while we're on the topic of weird TVs and monitors, I want to talk about the Samsung TikTok TV. What's that one called?
Zero.
What's that about?
This is a television that when you connect a Samsung phone to it, specifically a Samsung phone, there's a motor in the back that moves the phone or moves the television from the traditional landscape to portrait.
Okay.
So the phone's the television slowly rotates to the phone style where it is there, and then you essentially can then wirelessly cast your phone.
Watch some Instagram video on it.
Yeah. And, you know, so through the Samsung SmartCast network,
mm-hmm.
be able to then beam your phone, the entirety of your phone, to the television, not have black bars on the side. You know, you're then getting the entirety of that 45 or 55 inch screen. You know, that you can then, you know, watch vertical videos on, because I'm going to say out loud in front of the YouTuber who will hopefully not chuck a bottle at me as soon as I say it.
Oh, man.
People really dig vertical video.
You know what? I actually also like vertical video because I use a phone, and it's
right.
like, that's just the comfortable way to hold your phone. But at the same time, I think there's very little vertical content that
you want on your TV.
Yeah, like none of it looks good at that scale because it's just made to go on your like 5 or 6 inch screen on your phone.
Yeah,
so,
the platforms have not caught up with this equipment yet, and I'm not convinced there will ever. Really
I disagree.
Be a
I mean,
platform.
One of the biggest platforms in the world is Instagram Stories,
which has some of the worst video quality.
Yeah, they're still largely 720p for even.
Oh,
on
no,
phone,
no, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm just saying there's a lot of content out there that's portrait. First.
I'm not saying that there isn't content that's portrait first. I'm saying I don't want to see it on anything bigger than a Fold.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Fair.
And then,
right.
Well, actually, it screws up on the Fold, so I don't want to see it anything bigger than a Note.
I mean, have you ever watched an Instagram story on your computer from Instagram.com?
Oh, yeah.
It's awful.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's
But even, like, TikTok videos are largely 720p.
Yeah.
You know, they're not particularly high resolution. Putting them on one of these gorgeous televisions would be a disservice to everyone because it's just so bad.
Right.
Okay, so DreamWorks co-founder Jeffrey Katzenberg and former HP CEO Meg Whitman are about to launch a new video streaming platform called Quibi. Quibi is
mm-hmm.
meant to take on the others, the Peacocks and Netflixes and whatevers of the world, but it's meant for web-first and which often means portrait first viewing. Mm. And what they're purporting is you as a user are going to be willing to switch between landscape and portrait if the content asks you to do it. And
which was the idea of the name of Go90, the service that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. Sure.
Also, YouTube actually supports that as well. If you're watching a vertical only video, it'll actually fill your screen on your phone.
And the you've used the spectacles, Snapchat, that actually does it natively, right? If you flip, because it's 360 degrees.
Yep. Yes. Well, yeah, it does more than just flip it. Yeah, because it's a circle, you can have it at any.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, but you see different perspectives depending on how you orient.
And
phone.
Really interestingly, it's bad at each one of those perspectives.
it doesn't also really matter
what angle you have the phone at. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, we are in this really kind of horrible hellscape if you're a content producer at a show like this, where earlier I was watching Samsung's cute robot roll around, and I had my Fuji in one hand shooting landscape so I could do a wrap-up video on YouTube, a proper real video. And right next to it, I had my phone in portrait so that I could do an Instagram story at the same time.
Yep.
And you really, you can repurpose one for the other, but then it's crappy. Like, you actually have to do both.
Yeah, and the thing is, the most you see at one of these situations is you see, if you're shooting now, if somebody's shooting with a phone, it's almost always vertical.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're not seeing people go landscape with a phone nearly as much, because if they do, then they go to a camera.
Right. Yeah. Well, Russell and I just got back from seeing this incredible piece of tech at the Sands, and I'm filming him with my Sony like real camera, but at the same time in my other hand I'm holding my phone so I can take an Instagram story.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
The trials and tribulations of content producers, folks.
Hashtag content.
You know,
okay,
live a tough life.
So you know there were a lot of other interesting things from. I mean, let's continue talking about Samsung, because, you know, I want to talk about the Rolly bot.
Bolly!
Sorry, the LG rolling bot in another form.
Yeah, I made that joke already.
It's enough.
It's true, but
it is very true.
It's fine.
I think my favorite part about Bolly is that most of its demo video was a lie.
Oh,
when
does that ever happen?
Right. One of the fascinating.
So why don't
things,
you tell people what Bolly is?
Yeah. So Bolly was kind of this interactive artificial intelligence bot that's supposed to follow you around and be your companion and talk to you and do stuff with a little camera.
It's like
on
a little
front.
Bigger than a softball.
Yeah, not a huge thing. It rolls around on the ground.
So Samsung's just selling me.
Right. Yeah. has some rubbery material to it, which is gonna be great for when it gets inevitably picked up by a dog and then carried off into the wilderness and buried. It was this kind of cutesy thing that makes, you know, happy little chirping noises, and it's supposed to interact with you via voice. You can, you know, it's supposed to work with some of the Samsung smart tools. One of the biggest things from its promo video is all of this interaction with smart tech in your house. You're supposed to be able to give it permission to a bunch of stuff, and it's supposed to be able to go and do a bunch of these things for you automatically.
Right, it's supposed to roll around your house and see things and interact with them.
None of that is ever going to work. The notion that this ball is going to roll around and see, you know, your dog is you know, pawing at the back door, and so you turn on the lights to the back door so that it can go outside. Is, you know, like, none of that stuff is ever going to work. And if it does, it's going to work once and then never work again. Mm-hmm. Because the ball is on the ground, and that is not where any of your smart things are. And so being able to look up from the ground, it's not going to see most of the things that are going to matter to begin with. Mm-hmm. Also, it, you know, if it has ambient temperature sensors in it, which I may have missed whether it does or not, the temperature on your floor is often very different from the temperature up where your face is.
Sure.
And so if it is controlling your thermostat, it's just going to make you mad.
Yeah.
There's a lot about this that I was like, this is a really neat idea that is never going to work.
Now, Michael, defend why this is an amazing invention that everyone should have.
Now, Russell, let me tell you what. You know what's crazy? I misconstrued Bolly, because I'm continuing. I auto cannot deal with the fact.
And that's
that this
that's Ballie.
That's right.
Is there an E at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Anyway, I misconstrued Ballie, because I'm continuing a 9-year stretch at this point of never attending a single press conference at any trade show.
I'm really proud of you, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So I didn't pay attention. All people started telling me was that there was a cute little rolling robot that I needed to see. I was like, I have to go. I'm so excited. And I roll up, and I see the things, and I'm immediately enamored of this thing that follows
you
around and responds to command and stuff. I think almost. And when Samsung told me it was a utility, when Samsung told me it's everything Russell just said, I was like, oh, it seems to me that this isn't what this should be.
No,
this should be an iBook.
Yep.
It should be an IBO, for a Sony IBO that happens to be made by Samsung and is a Sphere.
Yeah, it should just be a cute thing.
It should be a, right, and I say that fully aware of the fact that social robots die. That's their whole thing. They come, capture your heart, and then they go out of business and die.
I sincerely look forward to your, like, moratorium video.
Right, but Sony, like, this is why IBO is the example. It's the one that hasn't died.
Yeah.
And Sony has been a relatively good custodian of it since shutting it down the first time and changing their mind. So, like, I don't know. It just seems to me that it's not a useful thing,
right.
But it could be a thing that could still be important in if people decide it means something to them.
And I just like to see somebody doing different kinds of robots that aren't these, you know, big, like, 3 to 4 foot tall, like, customer service type robots that everybody's talking about, like, oh, this thing's going to roll around your house, or it's going to roll around your airport or whatever,
yeah.
And it's going to have little expressions and a big screen on it, and it's kind of imposing.
And follow you around the airport.
I'm going to highlight just how much I agree with Andrew right now, because 4 hours ago, Hayato and I spent 2 hours wandering the South Hall of the Las Vegas Convention Center, which is completely full of exactly those service robots that Andrew was just talking about. And quite literally every one of them is some form of genuine nightmare.
Yeah. Like, this thing is going to sneak up on you.
It is. One of them was a child. It was shaped like a baby. And I walked up, and they were like, do you want to hold the baby? And Hayato was like, do it. So there is now a video of me holding this weird child baby robot that then started dancing in my hands. That I could not mask my discomfort if I was given $1 million.
Oh,
it was just,
yeah.
It was warm. It was warm.
Oh,
right. What did yeah. It to me, it was warm.
Come
it
on.
Was so awful.
This
so,
interaction
yes.
directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
Right.
Yeah.
I completely
like, the
agree.
Whole robot doesn't have to be something big like that.
Right.
It could be like a Sphero-sized thing.
Exactly.
But yeah. I agree. Like, it's a very lofty goal right now.
It does feel like robots are the drone of, like, the drone
yeah.
equivalent of 20.
How many drones are we seeing at CES?
Not
many.
Not
many. That was a thing before.
Okay, so we did see, though, today.
Oh, man.
This drone, it's pretty big. It's like the size of a Mavic, like a Mavic Air or Mavic Pro, but it's entirely waterproof. They just had it like flying under this huge stream of water.
Wow.
No trouble at all.
It jumped in and out of the water stream like rainfall.
Yeah.
Did not skip a beat.
And then
you can recalibrate or anything.
You can take its blades off, take the legs off and everything, and then you just hold it like a football, and it's got like a little hand strap, so you can use it for a handheld video with like the gimbal and everything built in.
Mm. Who made that?
Do you know the
company? Well, yeah, I'll have to hook you up with it after. I don't
yeah.
know the name.
Interested in seeing that.
It was very, very smart. And it had, like, had automatic, like, AI kind of detection. So if it sees, like, a person moving around and you leave it stationary on a tripod, it actually will follow that person and, like, use the gimbal to steer the camera. It's really, really cool.
I mean, this reminds me of the videos for Skydio's, you know,
the
Skydio R1 and R2.
I want them so bad.
And then when I saw the reviews, I was like, well, you know, every once in a while it works, and then it still gets caught behind a tree.
Yeah.
So we're not quite there yet. And I feel like it's the same with robots. Like,
oh, yeah.
Nobody's
and that's
quite
a
figured
way
out
less
exactly
complicated situation than navigating your entire home
yeah.
to the ground.
Yeah. For sure. I want it to be possible for us to. I mean, the only robots we interact with on a regular basis are vacuums.
Yeah. And they still get stuck on
and
shit
that's
all
the
over
thing.
Your apartment.
It would be super cool if Samsung, the company which makes some of these robot vacuums, would apply some of that same tech to one of these robot vacuums. I think a robot vacuum that has some smart home control is a lot more practical. It's obviously not as adorable.
Dual purpose, yeah. It's already surveying your whole house.
Exactly. It's a lot more practical to have that kind of multi-purpose, you know, tool than this bright orange ball that, I'm going to say it again, a dog will pick up and
yeah,
walk away.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So you walked around South Hall most of today. Other stuff that really caught your eye, both in a positive and negative way?
So Russell and I, we kind of went down to different parts of South Hall and just the convention center in general. We didn't expect to see much, but we did come across the coolest thing, like right before we came here to record this. It was this set of robot arms that
these things.
You put these gloves on and it follows your hand movement, like the robot's fingers will move along with yours, the arms move along with your movement, and the fingertips on these robot hands have little sensors, so it'll actually the wearer, so like Russell tried it on and he could feel when you like when somebody would like tickle the fingers on the robot hands, it would transfer that feeling back to his hands.
Yeah, or like when I went to pick up one of the things on the table.
You could feel it?
There was a tactile response on my actual fingertips when I had successfully gripped...
With the robot arms.
You know, and so that made it, you know, I wasn't just, you know, clenching down as hard as I possibly could to guarantee that I had a grip. As soon as I felt that, I knew that I had a pretty decent grip on the thing that I was then grabbing.
Wow.
And it made that kind of, you know, gentle touch a lot easier to deal with, which was very, very cool.
Yeah.
I think from a more kind of practical consumer standpoint, though, something I saw a lot of, way more this year than past years, throughout all of the show floor halls, has been small form real-time language translators.
Yes.
They have been all over the show floor. Some that plug directly into your phone and allow for kind of real-time translation between multiple languages. Some that are headsets. You know, earbuds that you wear one and the other person wears one and the software translates between them. And I know that, Michael, you've had some experience with some of these in the past and they've been kind of limited in their success.
Yeah, they have. Which isn't to say I haven't used good ones, but I've always just... I've always been dubious about their ability to be a lasting product category because our phones are already really good at doing the same job.
I think the only reason that I struggle with that, I think that largely you are right. I think that the microphones for our phones are not super great at far field. And so you really kind of have to put the phone up into some stranger's face to get that. Whereas a lot of these other ones that I'm seeing, it's either handing them a headset that they can then put on and then they feel that sense of control, or they are far field microphones.
Right. We're specifically designed to capture that.
To capture something that's at a distance. Yeah. And that is the only reason that I see it as potentially worth it. But even then, I mostly agree with you that your phone is ultimately going to be more convenient.
Right. And the microphone technology on those phones will continue to improve.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think long term you are right. But the only reason that I'm excited about them in the short term is that they are the benefit to them being purpose built is those microphones make it so that you're not jamming a phone in a stranger's face in a place that you cannot speak the language.
Yep. So it's you bring up translation, which is interesting because one of Google's many announcements here pertaining to Assistant had to do with interpreter mode expanding to businesses throughout the world. So you'll walk into an airport or a hotel and have a Nest Hub sitting there with interpreter mode enabled. And if you don't speak the native language, you'll be able to talk to the concierge or check into your hotel really easily. And I find that to be something that Google is singularly capable of, right? Of rolling out a product in beta form, you know, 18 months ago through now, where it is a commercially viable product where they're likely making money in some form, right? Because these companies are purchasing Nest Hubs if it's, you know, a hardware, or maybe they're paying a licensing fee or, you know, a maintenance fee or whatever it is. But it's available in 29 languages. Through many, many providers of services at these, you know, these public spaces, airports and whatnot. And it looks to be really interesting. And you'll be able to find it in places such as JFK Airport, LAX, in the Khalifa Stadium in Qatar. So places where a lot of people go through. And I'm wondering what you think about this, because Google Translate is by no means perfect. Yeah. It's far from perfect, but having these capabilities feels like something only Google can really offer at this point.
It kind of makes me wonder about having kind of in these places, almost like a Google powered, like, you know, smart mirror or directional display or something. I feel like when I go to a lot of different airports, there's a lot of people who want to go up to a specific thing to interact with it. You know, not necessarily rely on their phones, but to be able to go to a help desk of some kind.
Right.
And it seems unlikely that Google is going to design their own, you know, tool for that. And I think that one of the cool things about Assistant is that it can then be kind of woven into something like that. And I feel like if these airports and if the stadium and places are willing to go that step where they kind of have this kind of larger help desk environment, I feel like that could be really powerful for you know, kind of enabling that help without having, you know, a human being there that you know, has to then naturally speak multiple languages or anything like that. So I think that could end up being, you know, hugely helpful in a lot of those places.
Another Google announcement here was the expansion of Assistant in the home. You'll soon be able to leave sticky notes or the equivalent of sticky notes on your Nest Hub for people.
Mm-hmm.
I read that and I was like, you could just send them a text message.
No.
But you have kids who would probably benefit from this, so I wonder how you felt about that.
It's not just kids, like me as well. I get so many messages throughout the day. It's easy for me to get a message when, you know, 2 hours ago and then have forgotten about it by the time I get home. There, you know, it, this
you're
actually
seeing it in the context.
Seeing it in the
home.
Context is important. This actually annoyed me more than I got excited by it because it reminded me of what we have lost with Google Inbox. One of the best features to Google Inbox was being able to snooze something until I got into a specific location.
Sure.
You know, where I could save an invite for something to an event or, you know, a QR code for something that I needed to check into an event. And when I got to that physical address, it was at the top of my inbox.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Google Assistant is now reaching for something that feels kind of like that, in that it is cool for the home. I would really love it for it to be more contextually aware and be, you know, be a sticky note for when I get to a specific place or be a, you know, something like that, something that, that note that is then, you know, more contextually aware. But I do think for the home, especially being able to have that note in the context of the moments, is a really good thing. I hope that it is something that, becomes a bigger part of the Nest Hub displays, because it's all part of the facial recognition stuff. I get home, I walk in front of this thing and it chirps up and says, "Hey, Russell, you know, let me read you the stuff from the day." And that stuff isn't always super useful, but saying, "Hey, by the way, you left this note. Don't forget it."
Yeah.
I think would be really cool.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I still, as completely lobotomized as he now is, I still walk in the room and Jibo's still there and he still recognizes people. And he says, "Hey, Michael, how are you?" And I'm like, "Hey." Then having that leveraged usefully on a Google Assistant, I mean, would be tremendous on a Nest Home or a Nest Home Max or something.
I actually, whenever I go downstairs now and to the kitchen in the morning, my Nest Hub Max like does that ping because it notifies that knows that I'm there, and it still shocks me every morning because I'm not yet awake that it recognizes me, and I'm like, I don't look at me right now. Like, don't. I'm hideous. This isn't fair. But it's funny. Like, you do almost humanize these robots. And I just, it is interesting that, like, there is no overarching theme of CES 2020. But I think robotics is as close to we've gotten. This slow creep of normalization of home robots is as close to an overarching theme as I think we have.
Definitely robotics and kind of the contextual thing. There's also been... and this isn't something that is something that most of us would have noticed by walking the floor, but there's a new angle to a lot of the smart home tech, specifically for the elderly and infirmed. A lot of it has to do with kind of medical grade help stuff. There are belts that have fall detection built into them, where there are batteries that'll last a month. And if you are wearing one and you fall down, then it sends a notification to a caregiver or something like that. There's a lot of examples of that in the smart home area of the convention center. And that is definitely something I've seen increased this year over next. I struggle with this one a lot because I'm not sure how many sensors Grandpa's going to be cool with me strapping to him.
Yeah.
Especially since some of the ones that I saw were like smart diapers.
Yeah.
That let caregivers know when they have wet themselves. And I'm going to make this clear. I said this on Twitter. It does not matter if you are old or young. You don't need sensors near your junk.
Yeah.
That's not a thing that we need.
We won't talk about that CNET headline. Let's move on.
You want me to read that one?
No, I'm good.
Please.
So
let's talk about a pop socket wireless charger instead.
Let's not. So, Michael, I would argue that many of the best and most interesting announcements were actually Windows related here at CES. You know, we had the introduction of the Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Fold. You know, we have a new Threadripper CPU, which is going to cost like a $6,000 or something. We have these new modular Intel PCs.
The NUC things are very easy.
Right. We have Razer Tomahawk, which is... I think that's what I'm...
Oh, I want to talk about that for a second, actually. The Razer Tomahawk is a case. It's a basically a build-your-own kind of desktop case, but it's small factor, smaller than Micro ATX style case. It is hilarious what they are calling this kind of build-it-your-own thing, because the way that they've set this up is you take the Intel NUC thing, and for those who are unaware, the NUC is processor, RAM, storage, basically a laptop without a display is what these new things are. And it's, you know, it's 10th gen Intel, you know, running a lot of this kind of high-end stuff, but it is still laptop form factor. You are essentially taking this and sticking it into a daughterboard sled, and then the daughterboard sled has room for a GPU, and you can put whatever GPU you want into it. So you can put a high-end GTX, 2060 or something like that in this thing, and then that's it. You have the NUC, and you have this really high-end GPU, and you slide it into this Tomahawk case, and that's it. You then have a high-end gaming desktop PC that you quote-unquote built yourself out of these two and a half parts. And if you want to upgrade any of this stuff, the NUC is not upgradable. Like, you get the 16 gigs of RAM, you get the 10th gen Intel, so when you want to replace something, you can either replace the GPU, or you can replace literally everything else.
Hmm.
And the way that Intel is doing this is you then just buy another NUC board, and you pop one out, you pop another one in, and the everything just quote-unquote works inside of this system. And I think that is practical for people who want high-end gaming experiences and want that kind of desktop environment but don't have either the space or the desire to go and build their own PC. I think the people who build their own PCs are going to laugh really hard at these things.
I agree.
Speaking of crazy PCs, I do need to talk about the Alienware UFO.
Yeah!
Because this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. It's basically a Nintendo Switch that's powered by a high-end Windows CPU, like a Windows laptop, gaming laptop.
It's pretty big.
It's huge, but it's also still relatively portable.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of looks like a Switch until you see it with someone's hands.
It looks like a Switch from a picture on a dock somewhere.
It looks like a Cybertruck Switch. Then.
Right. That's it. This is the Cybertruck Switch. That's
exactly right.
But I love this idea, and I think that it's finally possible to build something like this where it's not going to have laughably bad battery life, and the it's actually going to work properly because Windows 10 isn't a dumpster fire for drivers anymore.
Yep.
And you can have Steam and you can have Epic and you can have these launchers that are optimized for smaller displays. I think this is super cool. There's obviously no pricing because it's a concept. But I would not be surprised if companies try to build something like this, if only because Microsoft xCloud is coming.
Right.
And Stadia is a thing. And these are great form factors for playing those games.
One unifying factor in it when it comes to games this year, the one big gaming trend that Nintendo started last year is this portable high-end gameplay experiences. We are going to see so much of that this year. HyperX is working on cases that allow you to put your phone in and wirelessly Qi charge the phone with a high-end battery pack and also have some active cooling. Razer is doing some stuff, even just simple cases that they started last year that you put on your phone that cools by 6 degrees, just by having the case on the back because the special kind of transit material that is on the back of the phone. Razer also did a new, they call it the Kishi, which allows you to dock your phone and gives you Switch style
love that
controls on either side. Super comfortable. Felt exactly like I was using a Nintendo Switch with kind of really nice buttons on the side. Fit any phone up to a giant Note 10. Someone had a OnePlus 7 McLaren that got put in there, and it fit in there with no problem. It was really comfortable. And it's zero latency because it plugs in via USB Type-C, has USB Type-C charging pass-through underneath of it. And, the previous version of this was Bluetooth and only really worked with the Razer phone. And while it was nice, it was really small and only worked with a limited number of phones. And Bluetooth introduces some level of latency no matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
So by having this wired thing, I think it was really kind of powerful. But there were so many examples of it here that this kind of ultra portable high end gameplay is what 2020 is going to be all about. Like we're going to hear so much of it from Microsoft, and Stadia is going to keep pushing. Like that's going to be a big thing this year.
I'm wondering about that because I've seen all these. I've been following them, and as a Switch fan, I'm already resigned to carrying around a Switch. If I'm traveling and stuff, I'm carrying around the extra thing. The Switch, I think, is a great product that, to me, makes that worthwhile. I know the mobile game ecosystem is better than it's ever been, and it's growing faster than it ever has. I still can't think of more than a handful of games I want to play enough on a phone to justify carrying around the accessory to make gameplay acceptable.
I think that Project xCloud is going to be the exception that proves that rule. Because having your entire Xbox on your phone is going to make a big difference. Now, the huge, kind of caveat to that,
is that neither Stadia nor xCloud are going to be able to work in the places where the Switch stands out. You bring a Switch with you, and you will usually pull it out when you are on an airplane, where Stadia and xCloud are never going to work.
Right.
You know, I tried xCloud while I was on a train from Baltimore to New York.
Oh, yeah.
And it nothing. It couldn't work. The latency was too extreme as I jumped from station to station, you know, across the network. It's the latency is just too much right now. Now, Microsoft is working really hard on that, and they hope to be able to make it so that it works pretty satisfactorily on a plane, or on a train, rather. But there are at least three of us sitting here who are regularly on trains who know what just watching a video can be like streaming.
Yeah. Or sending messages.
Sending email. You know, so like this is a genuine challenge. That,
not to mention even when you arrive and the things you deal with just in hotel Wi-Fi.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which would, I guess, be the second option. It's like, well, you're not going to travel with a big gaming laptop or whatever. Like you set up in the hotel. It's like, even that's not going to be good enough.
Right. And in those places, the Switch is always going to be the better system.
Absolutely.
You know, that is always going to be the superior thing. So I definitely think that there are going to be plenty of people who are going to try this year. I don't know how successful it's going to be. But it is clear that Nintendo being as explosively successful as it was last year has caused so many different companies to go, okay, so we need to focus here.
Definitely. Yeah.
It is crazy that only now PC builders are catching up to the Switch, even though it's been out for years.
Yeah.
Like, that form factor made sense to imitate 3 years ago, but it's only now that the hardware is getting, you know,
well, yeah. What was
capable
the,
enough of
what's imitating. The name of that company? Is it GPD?
Yes. That makes the tiny little PCs?
The people at GPT have got to be punching the air right now. Like, you know, they, for years now, they've been like, we made this ultra-tiny Windows thing. You should check it out. And everyone's been like, oh, you're adorable. Let's go away.
Yeah.
And so now it's like the people at GPT have got to be like, this is our moment. This is, we finally made it.
Maybe. And I don't know. I wasn't able to use one of those. But, you know, they run Windows. And that's, when you brought up the X1 Fold, Daniel, like that's a good example of like, I like Windows 10 sometimes. But when it's a form factor that is at all unusual or maybe pushes the envelope a little bit, it's kind of like Android. You never quite
ready
know
for that.
If you're gonna.
I think the biggest thing there,
with it.
The biggest indicator there of success on Windows for this kind of thing, especially in offline mode, is going to be whether Valve gets a UI together for Steam in these kind of hyper mobile environments. If Valve is able to create a Steam UI that works on these smaller phones or in the smaller phone shaped things,
mm-hmm.
I feel like that makes a way bigger difference in being able to play those kind of offline games. And Valve has historically done stuff like that. They made a giant UI for TVs when they found that so many people were hooking their computers up to televisions. They made the big screen mode.
Yeah.
They did a lot of work in making sure that their UI was friendly for virtual reality. So it would be very cool to see Steam, probably hopefully sooner rather than later, go and say, hey, by the way, you know, we made this kind of super micro UI for those things. And I think that will probably make a pretty significant difference in how it feels to play a lot of those games in that environment. The games themselves are still going to be kind of weird. Text is still going to be kind of small in those spaces, so it's never going to be perfect. But I feel like that launcher is pretty significant.
Yeah, I agree.
I just want to, before we move back to the world of Android and Google, I want to just touch on your CES pick, which is the Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Fold. You finally saw the final one, the production version, even though it's coming later this year. What is your take on it at this point?
So Lenovo, it should give us a really early preview on it. It's not a production version that we saw
today. Okay,
it's still pre-production.
But they did give us pricing.
Right, and it's just that the one we saw back in May was so early that we weren't even allowed to shoot portions of it because, you know, like the hinge was hanging out the side or something. You know,
right,
like
right.
It's crazy. So this one is a lot closer to production. We do have pricing, we have a vague release window, and we have a name. We didn't have those before. We also, and Andrew was there for this, he attested this, I feel like because the Galaxy Fold came out first in a mainstream way, we've treated all foldables in that context. So every single time we pick up a new foldable, at least me, I'm just kind of like gingerly, daintily moving it around.
Yeah.
And I'm like, can I touch, is it okay if I, can I? And they're all like, but from Motorola and the Razer to Lenovo and this X1, they're like, look, man, if you want to punch that thing to close it, go ahead. It doesn't matter. Yeah, they're talking about this carbon fiber reinforcing thing in the gutter behind the screen, the layer that they put on the LG panel on the OLED panel on the top of it to protect it from damage. And then they had the hinge. They had the whole thing disassembled in front of us, gave us the hinge to mess with. And Nirav and I were both, like, stunned at how difficult it was to change this hinge's position. When this thing is the size of the small portion of your thumb. And, like, imagine it's so difficult to bend your thumb that you almost can't do it with one hand. And that's because the thing is not a one or two. It's not a binary open or closed foldable. It's like a laptop. Mm-hmm. You can set that screen angle at whatever you want.
Hinge. You do whatever you want with it. And, yeah, I was also very surprised by the robustness of this thing. But ultimately, it's a ThinkPad. And so they're applying that level of, like, do whatever you need to do. This thing's going to be in the field kind of thing to it. And that also comes down to, like, hey, you just stuff the keyboard in the middle of it and you fold it on top of the keyboard.
That's the craziness. That's another thing we weren't allowed to show.
It's
back
like,
in May.
Wait, you're saying you can put something in between the screen and then fold it on top of it? That's like the biggest no-no for every one of these foldables.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, and not only does the keyboard go in there, and it wirelessly charges while it's in there.
Yeah.
And so you were carrying around this one little notebook that kind of folds up, and when it's folded, it feels like a moleskin.
Yeah.
It's got a real leather case. And that leather case has all these articulating metal members inside of it, so it can stretch with the device and stuff. The entire thing, from a hardware perspective, it's utter brilliance. It is a little concerning to me that they're launching with Windows 10. Because it's a very much a 10X device. I think
it's a little kludgy. They have this little status bar, little icon you tap to do multi-window stuff in it. Because
you can tell Windows what you want to do.
Because there's no defined middle of it in terms of, from Windows' perspective, it just thinks it's one screen.
Right.
It's a little funky.
So I don't like that. It feels like it's a device that they very clearly made to run Windows 10X. And then I think Windows 10X maybe got a little behind. Don't quote me on that. And then they were like, well, we're going to push it out. So Windows 10 for now.
Yeah, I guess that was my question, was is it just because Microsoft isn't ready and they feel the need to push this?
That's the impression that I got, but that may not be accurate. They may have always planned to do, let's do a pro version with Windows 10 for the people who need the full Windows 10 experience, and let's do a 10X one. I can't imagine a world where the 10X experience isn't worlds better.
It sounds like the Yoga book, where it launched with both Android and Windows versions.
Right, yeah.
And they were just like, we're not sure what's good with this form factor, so we're just going to give you both.
Yes.
And then I talked to Lenovo years later, and they were like, we sold almost no Android versions of this, which is why you just see you saw a second version of the same form factor just running Windows.
The Android version was awful.
Oh, it wasn't that.
It was entirely their software. Like, if they had done more work with Google or not used UI buttons that were from two generations ago, and I'm not talking about, like, their navigation buttons. I'm talking just that it was just gross looking.
Yeah.
The UI was just not attractive.
But that's another thing. It's like, it's what we were talking about before. It's like when Android, you try and force Android or Windows into a situation where it's like, I'm an OS that understands this, and you're making me do this.
Yeah.
It's going to be a kludgy, weird time, and that's sort of how it felt. They're saying mid-2020 on this thing. That gives them 4 to 5 months, I would say, to make it significantly smoother than what we saw today. So I'm a little worried about that.
But on the hardware side, it gave me a lot of hope for the future of this kind of technology scaling down to a much smaller size,
totally.
Especially with the robustness of the screen covering, the robustness of the hinge, the way they're handling the mitigating the issues of the crease in the middle with the screen. I mean, obviously the Razer phone, you know, really shows that in a smaller form factor, but you can see a lot of this stuff scaling down. I mean, even the Fold, though, is like, It's pretty chonky. Like, it's a pretty big device. Like, yeah, it feels like, you know, a closed moleskin or whatever, but also one that weighs like 3 pounds and is very dense. So you can tell this is very first public generation of this technology. Give it a couple more years and it can be down to something the size of the Galaxy Fold. And, like, if you could have that kind of robustness down in the size of a Fold, sign me up for that.
You win. Yeah.
So we were talking about, you know, making Android do things that it doesn't like to do. You used a pair of AR or mixed reality glasses called Nreal that is literally taking Android and putting it in three dimensions.
And doesn't
yet,
like that.
And yet it feels...
it worked
it,
so
it
well.
It felt super native in its early beta stage. The hardware is really intuitive, and I just fell in love. Talk us through Nreal, because I think this is exciting.
So these are augmented reality glasses in that they have... And I'm sorry, I keep saying that. These are mixed reality glasses, similar in function to Microsoft's HoloLens, in that it is a pair of black and white cameras on the front and an RGB camera in the middle, and it uses the black and white cameras to get a feel for the spatial environment around you, to get a feel for the shape and size of the room, and the color sensor to give you that kind of pass-through for when it is necessary to do so. And a pair of projector lenses that come down into a set of lenses that you can then see through. You see the real world, and then you see these virtual objects that are then overlaid over top of it. The very first thing that you see, this is not like HoloLens in the sense that it has its own computer built in. It is designed to tether to things via USB Type-C, which I originally was not a huge fan of. The idea of tethering to something for that kind of thing didn't make me super excited. And then I saw what Nreal had done with this software. You tether, you plug your phone in via USB Type-C, and then your phone becomes the remote control for the environment. So you are then holding your phone, and a laser is shooting out from your phone in the virtual environment, and it is now the laser pointer for the UI. So when you want to select an application, you are then gesturing with your phone and tapping on the screen with your thumb, and that is your selector. That is your pointer.
It's like using an LG remote on a WebOS TV.
Right, that's exactly right. So you the phone now has purpose, and so it is not just a tethered thing that is stuck to you. It is now a part of the navigation, and it's part of the instruction, which then made it feel a lot more organic.
That makes all the sense in the world.
It was huge. So then you've got your app tray. Every single Android app on your phone can then be launched, and I'm gonna say this as though people know what HoloLens is, in a very HoloLens-like fashion, stuck to the environment around you. So you can open Instagram, and Instagram then becomes a window that is in front of you somewhere. You can then open your email, and your email is then a window, and you can open YouTube. YouTube is now a 200-inch television in front of you that you can then pin as far away or as close as you want, and it just becomes a part of your environment. So you can sit in a train station waiting for your train to show up, launch a couple of applications, and while everyone else is walking around you, you then have this sort of virtual office in front of you with all of these applications that you would normally use, and it's their Android applications that are just pinned to this wall over here or floating in front of you. And that was just incredibly powerful to me. Like that and a Bluetooth keyboard, I could effectively have a version of my office anywhere that I was.
Sure.
And that was really, really exciting.
Physical, virtualized environment.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought that was really exciting to be able to have it presented that way. And everything felt very sharp. The text was easy to read even when it was further away. It was all rendered really nicely. It felt exactly like the Android apps that I was used to. And that's, you know, kind of using the applications that are on your phone right now. It also had a set of mixed reality applications that mapped to the environment in front of you. So from a gaming perspective, I could launch this one application and there was a version of Street Fighter that was then playing on the coffee table in front of me where I could grab a game controller and they were fighting on the coffee table. I picked some guy up and I threw him and he went off the coffee table and he climbed back up the coffee table and came over to fight. You know, because it was mapped to this 3D world around me, it was really cool. There was another game that Daniel played as well is you know, this zombie apocalypse thing where all of the carpeted space in front of me was just crawling with zombies and I could use my phone and flick bombs at them as they were crawling towards me. And they were crawling at you from everywhere that there was open space because the headset was mapping to these environments and saw it. It is not perfect. There's definitely some software bugs. And mixed reality is still a thing that is kind of difficult to sell people. But this was the first headset that I've used that first of all was something I would want to wear for an extended period of time because they're just glasses. It's not a bulky headset.
Yeah, I appreciated that. When you're talking about HoloLens, it's like I think of a huge helmet.
Right. No,
these are
80 gram glasses. Like these are not heavy glasses. They definitely are not things that you're going to wear all day because they're only partially occluded. The cameras are sitting up top, and so they're a little on the thicker side when they're up in that space. But these are glasses that you could easily wear for a couple of hours, or then just kind of tuck into a case in your pocket.
Oh yeah, they are small. I just looked it up.
It was really nice to be able to have that experience, and it is the closest thing that I have found to being able to see this. It's the closest thing I've felt to since using Google Glass for the first time that like it felt like we were pushing forward that kind of mixed reality, augmented reality future where we were getting closer to wearing these glasses felt something practical and useful.
I have to say, so I haven't used a lot of mixed reality, and you have. So you have a lot more to draw from in your experience. When I put these on, I legitimately gasped. Like, I can't put it any other way. I gasped at how impressive the whole thing was. I gasped at how smooth it felt. I gasped at the fact that they asked me beforehand what my prescription was for my glasses, and then they had a little box of lenses that they then magnetically attached to the headset.
Oh, it just snapped in half a second.
So like, anybody can use these if you have a kit. It just makes so much sense when you use it, and yet you nailed it when you said that it's really hard to sell people on this until they use it.
Right.
Like, I highly recommend you go to Android Central, you look up this article that Russell's written, and you see the screenshots that you can experience a little bit of what it's like to use these glasses, but it's nothing like actually throwing bombs at virtual zombies through these glasses. And I want this to be something everybody experiences. And it's funny because we have a bunch of people on staff who are like super hardcore VR stans, and they will like talk about Oculus Quest and Beat Saber to the point where it's like a religious experience.
Right.
But until you've used Beat Saber and you've played it and you understand what they're talking about, you're right. Like, why do you keep talking about this thing? And yet I think this was the season that everybody understood the value prop of VR gaming.
Yeah.
Because you could not buy and still can't buy an Oculus Quest in North America.
They're sold out everywhere. Yeah. It's really incredible. And a lot of that had to do with the price point. The Oculus Quest brought things down to $400 and promised something that was close to what you were getting with the way more expensive headsets, which reminds me of the price of these augmented reality glasses. They're $500.
Yeah.
Which is such a tremendous drop from the $2,600 that HoloLens was, even as a developer kit. Obviously, is still not yet to have a consumer release. But even if it's in its consumer form, these still look like giant, bulky, you know, helmet things. I'm genuinely impressed. This is something that you can pre-order now and is going to start shipping later this year. We don't have a firm date for it, but I am genuinely excited for when this thing becomes an actual consumer product.
And I'm genuinely excited for the photos that will be taken of you.
Oh, man.
Wearing these glasses.
So many pictures of my face staring in the middle distance. It's going to be awesome.
So good.
It's going to be great.
All right, let's wrap up by going around and talking about our favorite products or experiences that we've had here. We'll start with you, Andrew, because...
Man, you're going to pick me when I'm trying to think. Don't pick me because I'm trying to figure out what I want.
I can go first.
All right, Russell.
My favorite thing from the show this year is not necessarily a tech thing.
Is it a dog?
No.
Oh.
HBO is here. HBO had a series of dinners promoting Westworld Season 3. And they did this through a fictional company that is going to be a part of Season 3 called Insight. And all of the... You can go online right now and find trailers promoting Season 3, and it's a trailer for Insight. And the whole thing behind Insight is, give us your information and let us choose for you. Let us pick your future for you, and you will be happier for it. And so you go to this dinner... and it was it's a extremely posh dining establishment. It was just gorgeous inside and out.
It's like a billionaire's library.
It was exceptional. You walk into this place, they give you a table that you go to sit at. The table's got your name on a card. You sit down, and it looks like a paper menu where you're going to pull out the menu and choose from a list of things. It is not. It is actually food that they have already chosen for you. And it is not the same thing that everyone else at the table has. In fact, everyone at the table had a personalized thing that was made for them. And the host comes up and explains to you that they actually did research on you, and they chose these foods based on what they knew that you liked. So everyone at the table has this incredibly customized menu. And drinks that are at the table that are designed for what they think you're going to like. And the host then starts a conversation with you and some of the other people that are going to be at your table, and it becomes clear immediately that the host knows way too much about you.
Oh, yeah.
For a person that you have never met before, this guy asked me questions about a book that I had finished reading a couple months ago, because I had said on Twitter that I finished reading this book a couple months ago. And whoever was doing the research for this in order to prove this point about Insight had gone back into my LinkedIn, my Instagram, my Twitter, my Facebook back several months and created a list of talking points for this actor. Mm-hmm. to then did that for everyone at our table. So each table had a host, and that host just knew an enormous amount of personal information that I had chosen to share, but an enormous amount of personal information, and then used it to create conversations between the people at the table. You know, one of the guys at the table that I was at is a librarian and had worked at something, and I had just finished this kind of obscure book, and so he tried to start a conversation between the two of us for that. There was another guy who was a fitness guy, and he knew that I was preparing for a 10K run later this month, and so he'd used that to start this conversation. It made every single person at the table
wildly uncomfortable. Everyone at the table was just insanely uncomfortable because some of this were details that for me, it was really easy for me to pick something. I was like, okay, so you got that from my Instagram a couple of days ago. You got that from my Twitter a couple months ago. Like, I could pick it out pretty quickly. There was a guy at the table who was lactose intolerant, and the guy came up to him and said, "Your dessert, by the way, it says ice cream. I just wanted you to know we knew that you were lactose intolerant, so that is actually dairy-free ice cream. I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that." The guy walked away, and he goes, "Nobody knows that I'm lactose intolerant. I don't talk about it on Twitter. I don't talk about it on Facebook. My boss does not know that I am lactose intolerant. So I genuinely do not know where he got that information from." And he was unsettled the entire rest of the night.
Absolutely. Same thing happened to me 10 minutes after I walked down there. Yeah. They were like, the gentleman next to you is having lobster. Do you have any issue with that?
Yeah.
Is that a common question in restaurants?
No.
Not specifically.
So. I have a psychological problem with lobster that I don't talk to really anyone about.
Yeah.
Learning about this for the first time.
Yeah. I don't recall posting about it. I don't think any of you guys know. Yeah.
So it was amazing the amount of information that they were able to get. So then, you know, we finish eating, we get ready between dinner and dessert, and there's a keynote presentation. The keynote presentation comes up, and the whole point was, why give all of your information to these social media companies when you're going to get nothing in return, when you can give this information to Insight, and Insight will then guide you on the correct path, you know, give you the correct life choices in order to do things. And that is supposed to be the overarching theme to this new season of Westworld. What I will say is it creeped the shit out of me. And everyone else in that room was just so uncomfortable, and I loved it walking away from it. It was insane. I have never been more excited to sit down and watch a television show after being just mortified and really ready to just shut down all of my social media stuff and go live on a boat somewhere. Like, it was, there were
something
a lot of emotions.
This was not just them scraping Twitter. It was more them creating profiles of you based on other stuff that is just floating out there that you have no idea.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. Like there were definitely some things that he said where it was clear that it had come from one of my social media profiles. I said something about not ever considering eating pork ever again because I had this really great experience with the Impossible Pork people, and I have some weird issues with U.S. regulation for pork right now. And like there was something I had said an hour before going to this thing, and he had that ready to use as a talking point for some of the things. So some of this I knew was from social media, but they created these deep profiles for what I'm guessing were probably close to 300 people over the course of the two nights.
And the unease and that discomfort was compounded by the fact that every table had one person there, and you don't know this until you're done. If you figured it out,
there was a plant.
There was
at every
plant
table.
At every table. There was someone who was not. Who was not a guest. There was someone who was a host in disguise, presumably to, I don't know what the structural purpose of this person was, but I remember sitting down and this woman was the perfect amount of engaging, but not so much that I would remember her and a job and a location where she came from. That was not terribly interesting.
Yeah.
And I think their purpose was to serve as the sort of end piece, which is not terribly important. But if you did not pick up on it, you would never know.
Right.
So, Michael, I know you also had some Westworld experience at, I think, South By.
That's correct.
These kind of things make me really... I don't know anything about Westworld, but this makes me really, really want to just, pick up on this show the second I get home from CES.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I just want to go to the next one and just be, thoroughly unsettled.
The super cool thing about the Texas activation for South By was because the core of the original part of Westworld was go to this Wild West thing where you could feel like you're part of the Wild West. And so the activation in South By was very much that. Go feel like you are walking through the town of, what is
Mariposa.
The name of Mariposa, and be a part of the Westwood experience. This was way not that.
Completely different.
This was so unsettling. And
directly applying it to you, not just through your interest and not just through this culling thing where they can find information about you on the internet. That's kind of the parlor trick of it. Then applying that to this narrative of, hey, choices are full of stress in life. And you know how you make wrong choices?
That was the weirdest thing. She goes, choices are naturally full of anxiety. How great was it to not have to think about what you were going to have for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
We just chose for you, and it was all stuff that you liked. What if you just did that for everything? I was just like, I need to leave this room right now.
I like just having you guys do that for me. You guys just choose my beers.
Yeah, that's.
I just say yes to everything.
That's just being passive. That's not the same thing.
But it is. It absolutely is. It's about giving up more of the control of your life to these massive companies. And, I mean, let's get real for a second. HBO is owned by AT&T right now.
Right, yeah.
So this just has like another layer of grossness to it.
Oh, yeah. It was, trust me, I spent a very not sober 2.5 mile walk. Because when I got out of this place, I was like, I'm not getting in a cab. I have to process what just happened. So yeah, I walked the entire length of the strip to get back to the Encore, just like with a bottle of water in hand, basically talking to myself, wandering down the strip, trying to sort out how I felt about what had just happened.
Oh, it was, anybody that attended that had has U-verse at home, you just have to think, like, were they just, like, combing through the search history?
Oh, man.
Oof. All right, well, that's disturbing. maybe something a little lighter. Hayato, what was your pick?
My pick, I think it's got to be Impossible. I mean, you know, I didn't get to attend any of the Impossible events. I know they had, like, a trivia night that I didn't go to last night, and they had a press event the day before that Russell went to. But Russell texted me like while we were on our way to something else, and he's like, "Hey, where are you? I just got out of Impossible. I'm bringing you guys little takeout boxes." And you know, like Impossible unveiled new veggie-based pork this year, and it was fantastic from the takeout boxes that Russell brought us. I'm not vegetarian or vegan or anything. I eat a lot of meat, but also I could stand to cut back on meat, and I like Impossible and other kind of vegetable, like plant-based meat alternatives, because I think, one, they're just really good food, and it doesn't matter if you're vegan or not, like, they're just very tasty, but also it's a good way for people like me who eat a lot of meat but would like to have less of an environmental impact. It's a really natural way, instead of, like, having to seek out a lot of sort of, you know, maybe, like, I think a lot of meat eaters that think about going vegan, they're just like, well, I have to just eat salads and things that bring me no joy. And now you can look at this and think, well, I like pork. I can still eat pork. I'm just going to eat plant-based pork, and it's going to be largely the same experience.
Well,
I
but also
really
aside
great.
From that, this was a detail that kind of got undersold, is that because of the way this is made, the plant-based pork that Impossible is doing can be manufactured in kosher and halal
facilities.
Which opens up an entire category of dietary things for a group of people who would otherwise never touch anything pork.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was fascinating. And something that got really kind of underspoken through all of the coverage of it, including myself. I didn't do nearly enough talking about it either. But that was a really fascinating thing, is that there is now two very significant groups of people who are going to have an entire category of food that they otherwise would never have been able to try.
So I mean, that was interesting to me when you graciously brought me a thing of the Dan Dan noodles or Dan Dan noodles, whatever it's called. And I don't eat pork, and it's strange using chopsticks to eat something that looks very much like the thing that I've never been allowed to eat. And it felt very, it almost felt like I was breaking the rules.
It felt
a little subversive.
Cheating.
And even the fact that it did, even though I knew that I was eating, what is it even made of? Like beets?
So it's partially beets, and then soy, lye protein, and some mushroom bases.
Right. So nothing that I wouldn't normally eat independently
on any
given day.
Yeah.
And yet it tasted, from what I understand, indistinguishable from pork.
And that was my question. Was you said that you don't eat pork. My follow-up was going to be, had you never had pork, so that you had some kind of basis of comparison?
I've had pepperoni accidentally, but
that's clearly not the same thing.
Not the same thing.
I mean, I eat pork fairly regularly, just in, you know, like, pork tacos or pork whatever else, and it's not exactly the same, just like, you know, Impossible burgers are not exactly the same as
beef
burgers.
But it is definitely close enough.
It's very, very close. Like, I would never complain about, you know, having an Impossible burger versus a beef burger. It's so similar. The texture is very close. I think what you brought us was a little saltier than a lot of pork that I would eat, but that could also just be the fact that it was largely Asian cuisine, and Asian cuisine tends to kind of lean on the salty side of things. But yeah, it was fantastic, and it's like, you really don't have to think about it. Is this like, what is this made of or anything? It's just, as far as you can tell, it is pork. So I think that's really cool. I really like what Impossible does. That's got to be my favorite thing of the show.
I also want to point out that the first two favorite things were neither tech nor really anything to do with the tech industry, you know? And it just makes me... It just reinforces the fact that we shouldn't be here.
I very much want to point out, as an apology, that every single thing on AndroidCentral.com this week with my byline on it has nothing to do with Android.
Don't apologize. I want to tell everybody listening that will never stop. So Android Central is just a name. And content is...
Content is the game.
Is our game. All right, Michael Fisher, what was your favorite show?
Well, Russell stole my first one, and Hayato stole my second one. So, Andrew.
So, I'm going to bring something up that we didn't talk about for some reason, and I love it, but I'm also extremely disappointed, is the Skoggin Falster 3 smartwatch.
Okay.
I love it because of the hardware design, and I want to wear one, and I'm disappointed because Wear OS still sucks no matter what you do, and so I'm not going to wear one. But you should go look at some pretty pictures of it on Daniel's wrist on AndroidCentral.com.
It comes in blue.
On my Instagram,
it is stunning blue.
And black and silver.
And a nice chainmail band.
A lot of great band options, and not going to wear it.
Yeah. They've got some cool new trims and hybrids, too. They've got Fossil just dumped a bunch of new like casing designs and reviews. Yeah. And like they
and it's like
so
they're doing what they can.
Yeah, they're right. They can't help the platform they're on, but
yeah. The
hardware is
they do
a lot more interesting all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well...
How about you, Daniel?
So I have two, because then you passed, so I'll just go twice.
Pass? I got trounced.
Whatever. Same death.
It's my fault, because I couldn't...
You're not thinking outside the box enough, so I'm just going to...
I should have gotten into that suit 20 minutes ago. Go ahead.
Think outside the bun, because that's, you know, Burger King's got the Impossible croissant sandwich now.
Thanks, everybody. So my first is the Lenovo Smart Frame.
I was going to pick that, damn it.
Okay, so, but you already went.
I know.
Okay.
I couldn't make up my damn mind.
All right, well, I'll go on your behalf then.
Thank
so
you.
Lenovo Smart Frame, this is something that I never thought I would say, but I love these digital photo frames more than I ever thought possible, because I just love looking at photos of my daughter and my dog all day, and I want more of them in my house. The Lenovo Smart Frame is massive, it is expensive, and it does not officially support Google Photos. So why the hell would I like it? Because eventually, I know it's going to support Google Photos. It has to support Google Photos.
We got several months before this thing comes out anyway.
It's the most, like... impractical photo frame I've ever seen.
It's 21 inches. Just the display is 21 inches diagonal.
Yeah, and then there's the frame.
There's
that
another
you can
4 inches
change
or so for the frame.
If you want. It's an extra, what, $50 or so?
$40.
$40 to change the frame.
And it's $400 to start.
It really is the Samsung frame of photo frames. It's just overkill in
the
every
display
sense.
Is really good.
But it's a matte display. It's perfect. It's you can the viewing angles are perfect, the colors are perfect.
Automatically adjust color temperature, colors, brightness.
You can hang it on a wall. It's amazing. Every part of it, the hardware is incredible, and I want this so badly for Google Photos. My only concern is that the quality of my photos uploaded to Google Photos aren't good enough for this frame.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not
21 inch.
That's not Lenovo's fault. That's my fault. But yeah, I think this is exactly what I want out of a photo frame, and I'm probably going to spend $400 for it, so I'll get back to you.
That's amazing.
Second thing were the, hard to pronounce, so I have it up here, the Audio-Technica, I hate these names, ATH-ANC-300TW True Wireless Earbuds.
Oh, listen, shout out to Audio-Technica for having been doing the exact same shit for over a decade now, having received the exact same criticism for over a decade now, and just not caring at all, and just continuing to give these really difficult names and just thumbing their nose at everyone who says otherwise.
I mean, somebody besides Sony has to do it.
That's right.
I mean, like, the ATH M50X was pretty bad, but this is worse. So, these are true wireless earbuds. They're ANC. These were by no means the only... active noise canceling powered true wireless earbuds to debut at this show, but they are by far the most interesting. I got to try them on the show floor. They sound incredible. I'm going to put it out there. They sound better than the Sony WF-1000 XM3s. I cannot wait to get these in March when they come out. They're $230. And Audio-Technica said they basically washed their hands of all of the digital and wireless stuff. That's Qualcomm. Hmm. It's entirely powered by Qualcomm. They said they just focus on building the drivers and the housing and the analog stuff, and they left the digital stuff to Qualcomm. And I think it worked because it just sounded incredible. And the ANC, even on the show floor, was good enough that I mistook it for over-the-ear headphones. So I'm going to say it right now. These are probably my next. And they're $230. So I'm looking forward to trying those. And Michael, did you come up with anything?
No, I've been...
Okay, fine. So I'm just going to talk about the fact that you bought a Galaxy Fold. Can we talk about the fact that you spent actual money on a Galaxy Fold?
We don't have another hour.
Absolutely. I can talk about that very briefly in the context of a trade show, though. I have not been let down by it. The battery is insanely big, as we all know. It lasts all day without trouble, even at a trade show, which is very challenging given the RF environment and the fact that you're using it all the time. I have an acre of space, and I can put a widget with a calendar and a widget with my email on the thing. I don't have to open an app. I see my entire situation every time I open the phone. I can take notes really easily. It's just acreage. It's a folding tablet. Are you familiar? Do you have a moment to talk about the church and Galaxy Fold?
Unfortunately, for all of that, it still can't take a good photo.
Accurate. Oh. Now, that's not true, because it replicated Bader's head perfectly.
I am a block. Oh, I'm a Minecraft character.
That is such a bad picture.
Poor Daniel Bader's got caught in the
at least, no, it gave me a Reddit subreddit. I now have our Bader lore because of that photo. So thank you so much for that, whoever did it.
So sorry.
All right, we're gonna finish up. Thank you so much for following us throughout CES 2020. It's been a blast. You can find Andrew at Andrew Martinick. You can find Russ. You can find Michael at the Mr. Mobile. You can find Hayato at Hayato Houston. You can find Russell at Russell Polly, and me at Journey Dan. We are Android Central. We will be back next week with a new episode. And we love you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Stay mobile,
my
friends.